Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I was in kindergarten when the school had us head into the gym for a book sale. Some book caught my fancy, but I knew my family wasn't going to be able to pay for a book. Our neighbor, Mrs. Rush, was volunteering at the school that day, saw my interest in this particular book, and made sure that it was mine. We had books in our home, but with four kids, there was never a book that was just yours, that you own, that was my first. Was that the moment when I went on to become a lifelong reader, a lifelong learner? Possibly. There's an organization that's been making sure kids in Vermont and New Hampshire get books and develop a love of reading and writing. It's called the Children's Literacy Foundation, or CLIF. And joining us now is CLIF's founder and executive director, Duncan McDougall. Duncan, it's great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Great to talk with you again, Rick.
And listeners, if you have questions about the work of CLIF, or if you've seen what they do in action, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Duncan, what is the goal of CLIF?
Rick, CLIF's mission is to nurture a love of reading and writing among low-income, at-risk, and rural children from birth to age 12 throughout Vermont and New Hampshire.
How do you accomplish that?
Well, we do that in a number of ways. First of all, we are very honored to be partnering with 68 professional presenters. They live locally in New Hampshire or Vermont. They are children's book authors, children's book illustrators, poets, storytellers, graphic novelists, and we pay them to travel in normal times all around New Hampshire and Vermont and go wherever the kids are gathered. So we work, for example, in low-income housing developments and shelters. We work in prisons. We work with refugee kids and migrant kids and foster kids. We work in schools and libraries. So wherever the kids are, you know, whether it's up on the Canadian border or, you know, on the border of New York or wherever, we send our presenters up there, and they work face-to-face to inspire love of reading and writing. We also provide a lot of support to the people who support the kids. So we have free conferences for school principals and teachers and reading specialists and librarians. We have a lot of events for parents. Many of the parents that we serve themselves are not really strong or confident readers, and so we teach them how to successfully share books and stories with their kids. And last but not least, we give away tons and tons of brand new books. We only give away new books because the children we serve, low-income, at-risk, and rural kids, often have few or no books of their own at home. And this past year, we gave away almost $900,000 worth of brand new books. And the last thing I'll note is that at our events, we don't give every child the same book. Instead, we do the reverse. We lay out hundreds and hundreds of beautiful, inspiring titles, and we let the kids choose what they want to read. And research shows that when kids get to choose what they want to read, they're much more likely to enjoy it and to continue reading.
So I think you started this back in 1998. So what were you thinking 22 years ago when you started this venture?
Well, I was looking to change directions. I had been working in business down in Boston, and I knew that I wanted to spend the rest of my career in the not-for-profit world and thought about what I really cared about and where I could make a difference. And I had been a teacher briefly and a writer, and I knew how critically important it was for kids to develop a love of reading and writing. It completely changes their trajectory and opens so many doors to them when they grow up with strong reading and writing skills and with a love of reading and writing. So I felt that that was an area where I could make a little bit of a difference and started CLIF. I was a volunteer executive director almost 23 years ago, and we had a small board. Now we're about 110 people when you include presenters and staff members and board members and volunteers. So we're a big crew. We all love reading and writing, and we all love sharing that with the kids in our communities.
That is outstanding. So I guess the next question is, you know, how do you know that this is working? How do you know that this really has an effect on all these kids that you've worked with through the years and gotten books to?
Sure. It's a good question. So every year we hold anywhere from about 750 to 1,000 events across New Hampshire and Vermont. That's a lot of events. And this past year we had attendance at our events was almost 50,000. So it's a lot to track. But after every sponsorship, every event, typically the organization that's served, whether it's a shelter or low-income housing or school or library, the representative will get a questionnaire. And they're asked, you know, how did it go? How many kids were there? How many parents were there? Do you have any recommendations, a way to improve it? What worked well? What didn't? And we learn from those questionnaires, and oftentimes we're in personal connection with those folks, so we can talk with them and find out ways that we can improve our programs. And frequently, we change our programs, we revise them based on feedback that we get from the families that we serve and from the organizations that we serve. So to answer your question, how do we know it works? We know because from that feedback and from the questionnaires, we get tons and tons of responses about how kids are more interested in reading and writing. They're reading and writing more often. They get their first library card. They're reading a wider array of books. And we hear this from parents and from teachers and from other adults who are involved in the child's life.
Now, Duncan, I think as we are speaking, there are book giveaway events going on in a couple places in the state this morning. Am I right?
I'm sure there are. I actually haven't looked at the schedule. Typically, there, you know, we're in about, in a typical time, we're in about three or four different towns almost every day. So, yes, I'm sure there are.
Wow. Yeah, I think I saw maybe Barry and Windsor or, you know, two places like that today. You all can make sure that I'm right and find out what Cliff is doing and where they are. They're at cliffonline.org. Now, the virtual author series you talked about, that gets rolling again in January. Tell us about that.
Sure. So normally, as I was describing, we send these presenters out to work face-to-face with kids. But during time of COVID, oftentimes a lot of our presentations, when the weather was better, were outside in a field or in a parking lot. But now it's winter. All of them are virtual. And so another way we're trying to reach out to families and kids, regardless of whether we're working with them directly, is that we have a virtual author series. So every week we have a new professional presenter who gives an hour-long presentation online. Anyone can watch it live online, and we put the recordings on our website, as you said, cliffonline.org, and that's Cliff with one F. And so we have dozens of those presentations online, and any family, any school is welcome and encouraged to take advantage of that and watch them. So if you go to our website, under resources, you can see the virtual storytelling series. And I should also note, since so many families have kids at home, they're part-time or full-time, we have hundreds of ideas, low-cost and no-cost ideas for inspiring young readers and writers, for things that families can do together. And we have lots and lots of training videos for families to learn how to successfully share books with kids in a really fun and exciting way. So there's a ton of free resources on our website, cliffonline.org, and we encourage people to take advantage of them.
And as Duncan mentioned, it is Cliff with one F. I think Cliff Bar stole the spelling from y'all, but
they did. Yeah. We didn't want to sue them. We let them go.
Well done, Duncan McDougall. Yeah, cliffonline.org. This virtual author series, this use of presenters, you mentioned authors, illustrators. Why was that something that you incorporated into the mission of what Cliff does?
The presenters themselves, you mean, or the virtual version?
Well, both, actually. Yeah, address both of that.
Well, the virtual version, obviously, because of COVID, because it's right now is not the safest thing to do for presenters to travel and visit schools, so they're doing it virtually. But before then, I think it's so important for these presenters, you know, many of whom have written 5, 10, 20 books, who have created amazing works, to share their love. And when kids see an individual so excited and learn that someone in a town just like theirs has spent their livelihood and their lives creating art and coming up with stories and coming up with poems and creating graphic novels, and that's what they do for a living. That's a very inspiring thing. And it's one thing to read a book that's exciting to you. It's another to talk to the individual who came up with that book out of their own imagination and to learn how they did that and how books are created. So that's, I think, our secret sauce is the passion and the inspiration of these 68 local professional presenters. And every kid can look at them and not say, well, this is someone from California or some other place. They have a special experience. No, this is someone from a town just like theirs. And this is what they do for a living, and they're great at it.
Duncan, when you're at the events, when they're in person, tell us about what you observe in the children involved.
Well, I think a lot of people are very surprised, Rick, in this day and age with so much electronics and other distractions, how excited kids get when they encounter really fun, inspiring books and wonderful presenters who are great storytellers. Kids are wired to love stories. And when they come up with books that are of interest to them, they can't help themselves. And we have seven programs, all of which are completely free, and they work in a variety of venues, schools and libraries and a number of other locations we'll talk about. And inevitably, each program involves setting out tables covered with brand new books, hundreds of beautiful titles. And we say to kids, come on up and choose some books to keep. And when they see titles, you know, on everything from science to fantasy books to hunting to dancing to NASCAR to whatever it might be, if it really grabs them, then they are so excited. And whether they're inspired, active readers or not, or if they wouldn't touch a book with a 10-foot pole, they cannot help themselves. And we love to see that. And I should note that I really encourage people to go to our website because, as I said, all our programs are free. And they operate in towns all across New Hampshire and Vermont. So chances are your town has an organization that would qualify for applying for a free grant. And we have a couple of grants that are currently open, one of them called the Cliff Year of the Book, which is a $25,000 grant that goes to an elementary school in New Hampshire or Vermont, where at least 35% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch, and at least 30% of the students score below standard in reading and writing. And that comes with a huge range of support, books for the library, books for the school library, public library, books for classrooms. Usually 6 to 8 professional presenters come and talk with kids at the school, and every child in the school gets 10 brand new books of their choice to keep over the course of the year. So we encourage anyone who knows a school like that to encourage them to apply for this grant.
Well, the website, again, is cliffonline.org. Okay, that grant, those books, this whole program, it costs some money. How are you funded there at Cliff?
Well, Cliff is, I think, quite unusual in that we don't receive state or federal funds. So from the very beginning, we've made that decision, and we're completely community supported. We receive the majority of our funds from individual donors. Each year, we usually have more than 700 donors from more than 30 states and 2 or 3 countries. So we're very widely spread in our family of donors. We also receive donations from foundations and companies and social organizations. And speaking of supporters, I should also note, Rick, that this time of year, we have a number of book drives that take place in bookstores all across Vermont and New Hampshire. And bookstores usually will offer a small discount if someone would like to buy a book, and then they have a box right nearby, and you can put the book in the box and give it to Cliff, and we will make sure it gets into the hands of a deserving young reader and writer. And it's a great time to support local businesses. And so I should note that some local bookstores, including Bridgeside Books in Waterbury, Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Flying Pig in Shelburne, Phoenix Books in Essex and Burlington, Norwich Bookstore in Norwich, and many others are supporting Cliff through Book Drive. So we encourage you to support them as well.
That is brilliant. Duncan, how do you help rural libraries?
That actually, Rick, was our very first program in 1998, and since then we've partnered with probably close to 90% of the rural libraries across Vermont and New Hampshire. And what we do is they apply, and it's a free grant, and if they're sponsored, then the library gets $2,000 worth of brand new hardcover children's books that the librarian gets to select to fill in gaps in his or her collection. And the school library gets $500 worth of books. And then in the fall, we send a professional presenter to speak to all the kids in town about the power and the joy of books and stories and reading and writing. And we give a grant to the public library so that they can do some family programming. And then in the spring, we send another presenter, again, author, poet, storyteller, graphic novelist. And at that event, every child in town gets two books of their choice to keep.
Duncan, do you remember a book early in your life that inspired you to be a lifelong reader and learner and writer?
It's a good question, Rick. I would say there are two books. One I can remember so clearly reading on a rainy day, and it was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm. And I just fell completely into that book. And that was just a joy to read, and I've reread that book many times. And the other experience I'd love to note for the teachers out there is in about grade three, I had a teacher, Mr. Very, who chose to read an adventure book. I'm blanking on the name right now, but every class for about a month and a half or 2 months, he would read a chapter from this book, High Citadel, by Desmond Bagley. And I was so entranced with that book, and that, I think, was one of the biggest inspirations for me. I didn't realize books could be that exciting, and every day I couldn't wait to hear what happened next in this adventure book. So I strongly encourage teachers and parents and everyone to read with kids as much as possible. In fact, as I tell parents, because I speak with adults a lot, I say as long as a child is safe and healthy and loved, there is nothing that we can do that has a greater positive impact on a child's potential success and the opportunities available to them later on in life than to help them become strong readers and writers and avid readers and writers. And there's no better way to do that than to share books with them as often as possible.
You know, even in eighth grade, I had a teacher who read to us, you mentioned adventure book, and it reminded me, I don't know what the name of the book was, but I'll never forget the character was Froggy Bates, and she read it every so many days, and at first it was like, what the? But then later, you couldn't wait till you learn more about the adventures of this Froggy Bates, so it really can be exciting. I want to get to more of your programs in the time we have, and one of the programs that Cliff has Duncan, is a program for children of inmates.
Yes, indeed. We've been running that for more than 15 years now, and we feel very strongly that we want to reach those kids who have the greatest needs. And children of prison inmates certainly fall in that category. They have a high likelihood of growing up with low literacy skills. Often their parents have low literacy skills. Unfortunately, 70% of U.S. inmates have low literacy skills. And so what we do is we partner with prisons across Vermont and New Hampshire. Usually they're multi-year partnerships. Some of these prisons we work with for six, seven, eight more years. And every 3 months or so, one of our professional presenters will go into the prison, work with the inmates, and give a seminar on different ways to share books and stories with kids successfully, even if one is not a strong reader, because many of them are not. But you don't need to be a strong, confident reader, because they're children's books. You can tell a story from the pictures. You can ask questions. You can make it a conversation. So we show them how to do that. At the end of every seminar, inmates get to choose brand new books for each child or grandchild, or if they don't have kids, nieces or nephews. They write a personal note in the book. Hey, buddy, I loved this book when I was a kid. I hope you enjoy it. Look forward to seeing you soon. Something like that. Then we take the books back. We wrap them up in packages. We have volunteers label them and stamp them and send them out. And so we have kids from inmate families who have entire libraries of books. They might have 10, 15, 20 books that over the years they've received. We also go in and do fun storytelling events. It's called Family Fun Days. And we have food and entertainment and games and storytelling by a professional presenter. And then every child gets two books to keep. And we also, Rick, have a wonderful program called the Storybook Program, where we've provided recording equipment to the prisons, and inmates get to record onto MP3 or CD a children's book of their choice, which we donate, and then that book and the recording is sent home to the children, so a child can still hear their mother or father's voice and have the book in their hand as they're being read to.
Wow. being around for as long as you have, many of the children you served early on, at least, are adults now. Do you ever hear back from them and their stories?
You know, we don't. And I think in part it's because a lot of the work that we do serves these kids when they're very young. And, you know, when you're an 8-year-old or 6-year-old, you really don't know or care who it was that came to serve you, but you do remember the impact that you had when, you know, a great presenter came and talked with you and when you got some great books that you couldn't put down. So it doesn't bother us that we don't hear from them, but we certainly hear from their teachers and their parents, and we see the excitement in the kids on the spot. And that's really all the payback that we need.
What's next, or what haven't I asked you about regarding Cliff that's really important for listeners to know about?
Well, I again really encourage folks to go to our website. It's Cliff, C-L-I-F, online, O-N-L-I-N-E.org, especially in this day and age when a lot of families have kids at home. And they're trying to figure out ways to inspire them and stimulate them. We have hundreds and hundreds of wonderful ideas. We have videos. We have recordings of awesome presenters who are nationally, internationally known. And they're right available on our website for free. And then we also have, starting in January and February, again, we'll have every week a live free presentation by these presenters. And if you go to our website under What's New, you can see the list in January and February. And we also started something new, Rick. It's an adult book club. So we have our presenters, and so adults in the evening for an hour or a little bit longer can talk with a professional presenter and find out about their books and hopefully read the books in advance. And we're very excited that on February 12th, Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, who also recently wrote a children's book, is going to be our presenter. So we're excited to have that, and we'd love anyone who would like to talk with Dan Brown and hear him live to join us for that event.
So good. Duncan McDougall is the founder and executive director of CLIF, the Children's Literacy Foundation. You can learn more at CLIFonline.org. Duncan, it was a pleasure having you on the show today.
Great to talk with you again, Rick. Thank you so much.
Take care. The CBS News Update is next, and then we'll be back with Father Matthew Wrench of the Roman Catholic communities of Waterbury, Waitsfield, and Moortown here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I've mentioned several times that I want this show to not only cover issues, but be a place where we meet our fellow Vermonters from all walks of life who have an interesting story to tell. And I've asked you to help with recommending people who you think I should talk to. Last week, I received an email from a listener who suggested I speak with our next guest. He's Father Matthew Wrench, the pastor of the Roman Catholic community of Waterbury, Waitsfield, and Moortown. And he joins us now. Father Matthew, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Good morning, Rick. Can you hear me?
I can, loud and clear. You sound robust.
Excellent.
Good. And if you'd like to ask Father Wrench a question or share a comment, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Father Wrench, is this the busiest week of the year? Is that Easter week? What's it like for you during a Christmas week?
Yeah, I would say it is just about the busiest week of the year. I tell people it's kind of like having an extra weekend stuck in the middle of the week. You know, because you have the regular weekend schedule, and then you pop Christmas in the middle, and then New Year's is another big feast day for the Catholic Church.
All right.
So it's it really piles up. Yep.
Yeah, so most of us would like that extra weekend in the middle of the week, but I understand for you it's kind of the reverse.
That's right. For me, it's the busy time. That's right.
Well, describe the responsibilities of a Catholic priest.
Nice. So the main responsibility is built around all of the sacraments. right, the special instruments of grace that God gives through the church. So the main one is celebrating Mass. So I do a daily Mass, and then on the weekends, the Saturday Vigil Masses and the Sunday Masses, prepping the homily for those so that they're not super lame. And then any preparation for the other sacraments, baptism, marriages, doing anointing of the sick, so going to hospitals. That's probably the best way to summarize it, is just any of the sacramental prep is up to the priest.
Why did you want to become a priest?
All right, here we go. It's always a big question, I think, for any priest when you ask him why,
right.
What sparked him.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of factors. One big factor for me was reading C.S. Lewis. So when I was in high school, I read The Screwtape Letters, which is a famous work of his where he kind of pretends that one devil is writing to another devil, giving advice on how to steal souls. So it's kind of a darker book. I think I kind of overdosed on it. And then I read another book of his, Mere Christianity. And both of them just, they blew me away. I thought, this man is amazing. These books are fantastic. And I think, I would say, I don't know if I had any kind of questions about Christianity or was explicitly asking, all right, is this true, or am I just going through the motions? Am I just doing what my parents have taught me? But I think those questions were somewhere in the background, because at every page, C.S. Lewis seemed to answer a question that was kind of, brewing under the surface. And at the end of the book, I thought, this man has shown you that this, it's true. And if it's true, then it's the most important thing in the world, and I can give my life to that. So that would be the story in a nutshell, I guess. But there were other moments along the way, too, meeting good priests, good people who kind of encouraged me in it. I'd also say this, that when I met a priest that I thought was not doing a great job, that also kind of sparked me to want to be a priest.
Yeah.
So I would say, no, you can't do that, And I would think, all right, if I'm going to be a priest, I'm not going to do that, whatever. So
when you decide to become a priest, you're from Vermont originally. Did you decide then that you would want to serve in Vermont, or how does that go of where you wind up in the end?
Right, good question. So someone who's getting set to go to seminary, he can basically choose whatever diocese he wants to study for. So, yeah, I ended up choosing Vermont because I grew up here, but I was kind of on the fence between here and signing up for Arlington, Virginia, the diocese down there where I went to college. And some of the priests down there were, they were plugging for that. But eventually I thought, no, I'm gonna sign up for Vermont. And then they send you wherever for seminary. The seminary can be out of state, out of country, wherever. But the whole time they're kind of sponsoring your studies. So when you're done, you return.
So, Father Matthew, back in the day, you'd have three priests at one parish. Now you have one priest running three parishes. That has got to be incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it's, I guess, not what everybody signs up for. it's a lot. One of the Vicar General the other day, he said, sometimes it feels like we're ministering to buildings and not to people, which kind of struck home because it does, you're kind of pulled in different directions a little bit. But that it's all for the good. And every time I say go to Our Lady of the Snows down in Wakefield, I think, on a lot of levels it makes sense that I'm this one person doing this drive as opposed to everybody who comes to church driving all the way, somewhere else.
Right.
So it's, it's a sacrifice, but when it's worth it, it's worth it. So.
And with COVID, how much interaction can you have with your parishioners?
Oh, COVID is the worst. Can you close me on that?
Yes.
It's terrible.
If a Catholic priest says it's so, it's so.
That's right. I think it's actually in scripture. I think it's in there. No, it's been tough because this is, my first assignment on my own, but I just started this past summer. So we were already in the midst of the pandemic. So at the most, I know what the top half of people's faces look like, you know?
Right.
It's just, and sometimes I don't even recognize them, you know? They'll say, oh, Father, good to see you. And I say, I have no idea who you are. So not only the difficulties of COVID in itself, but then starting at a new place with COVID just complicates it even more. Yeah, it's not great. But to answer your question, we have services that are kind of spaced out the way that everything else in the world is right now. So, you know, our capacity is between 25% and 50%. We rope off some of the pews, and as I say, people wear masks. So it hasn't been terrible, but definitely challenging.
Father Matthew, why has the number of men entering the priesthood dropped off so significantly?
Ooh, yeah, if I had the one sentence answer to that question, I'd probably be a bishop or the pope or something, you know.
We're hoping that would happen.
Again, there's definitely many factors that goes into something as, you know, as big as that. My suspicion is that we've suffered a lot from kind of losing focus on the truth of religion. So that I think our society kind of approaches religion the way it approaches sports, if you will. You know, we say, well, choose your sport. If you like it, if it's helpful, great. If it doesn't, great. You know, it's all kind of up for grabs. And we don't appreciate the fact that religion is making claims about how things really are, about whether God really exists and Jesus is really his son and he really offers grace through his church, all those sorts of things. C.S. Lewis, to go back to him, he said, the claims of Christianity, if they're true, then they matter immensely. And if they're not true, they don't matter at all. Hmm. So what that means is someone who has appreciated that will say, all right, if they're true, I can give my life to this. Whereas someone who says, well, religion is fun, it's good, it's kind of helpful, it's kind of like sports, helps people feel good, like that's not something that you're going to give your life to. Even if you like it, it's not a life-changing type of thing.
Right.
If that makes sense. So that's my suspicion is that that is a big factor in the drop-off.
You mentioned earlier that COVID is the worst. So you've been using Facebook Live for masses. Did that require you to conduct the mass any differently?
No, it's really very low impact, which is nice. I set up my phone. I have this little shotgun mic, put it at the first pew, and start it before mass and do everything the same. It's it's really nice. I don't have to shift at all.
And now that video presentation has been picked up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so besides having it on Facebook, Tony Italiano, doing the TV for The Valley, he said he just takes the live stream and pushes it out onto the TV. So we just started last Sunday. We have some glitches to work out, but overall it worked well. So going forward, as long as we're still doing the live stream, he said he can do that for us. So 9 a.m. morning mass is on the TV as well.
Have you gotten any reviews from your performance so far?
Well, none that I want to share.
That's fair enough. Omission can still be a sin, Father. Just remember that. So. Let's talk about something that's very timely, because this is the week definitely of Christmas and holiday masses. So how are you going about that for people to attend? Do they need to make reservations? What's the requirements there?
Yeah, that's what we've done. Yeah, have people call in and make a reservation so we have a bead on the numbers. So I think all the masses that we have scheduled are full. Here at St. Andrews in Waterbury, we have the parish hall as well, so we'll kind of use that for overflow if people just show up or whatever. But yeah, we're doing reservations. then I'll live stream. I only have Wi-Fi at here at St. Andrews that reaches over into the church, so that's the only one I can do the live stream from. But I'll live stream all those masses. So the 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. Christmas Eve, and then the 9 a.m. Christmas morning.
Nice. You mentioned earlier about preparing a homily. How do you go about preparing that for a mass?
Good question. So usually I sit down with the readings, the readings that will be used at mass, mm-hmm. read through them, focusing particularly on the gospel. And then anything that kind of jumps out at me, I'll just make a note of. So after a read through, I usually have maybe half a page of just thoughts and random notes. And then I try to take those, especially the ones that I think are good, and organize them into kind of three sections with 3 points to a section. And if something can fit in that outline, then it usually comes off pretty well. And then I would say the two main things that I'm always keeping in mind are, what are the main mistakes that people are liable to make? Maybe without thinking about it or having it kind of explicit in their minds. But what's something that would likely be a misreading of this text? So one, I think, if there is a common misreading, I'm going to go after it. And then the second is to try to make it as clear as possible. So I really tried to throw in an example from my own life or the story of a saint or something to illustrate the point I'm making. Because I think if I just go gangbusters with theological language, it's going to be a nightmare. Nobody's going to get it. You
right.
know? So I try to dress it up a little bit so that it sticks.
We only have a couple minutes left. So Vermont is described as spiritual, but not necessarily religious. Is that what you found? And how does that make your job more difficult or interesting?
Yeah, that's definitely the general trend for sure. And every once in a while, I kind of hear reports of it. I guess I would say my main encounter with it is kind of secondhand. You know, the people in the church, the people I'm interacting with most, will say, you know, my daughter, my son, my cousin, whoever, they, you know, Father, they're spiritual, but, you know, they're not religious. And usually they're, you know, they're sad about that. So I don't always see it firsthand, but kind of secondhand, it's definitely something I hear about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, it means that a priest here in Vermont is in mission territory. Mm. You know, that the people aren't breaking down the doors of the church to come in. We have to go find them. We have to get on your radio show. And say, you can come. Come to church.
All right. Well, that's the first bit of outreach. Father Matthew Wrench is the pastor of the Roman Catholic community of Waterbury, Waitsfield, and Moortown. Thank you so much for your time this morning during this very busy week.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
All right, take care. CBS News is next. Then we'll be back to speak with John Sales. He's the CEO of the Vermont Food Bank. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. In the last decade or so, the term hunger has been replaced with the term food insecurity. But it's not just some fancy spin on an old concept. I've been hungry. I've never experienced food insecurity. We're going to spend the next hour exploring the difference between the two and hear about the statewide organization that spends every single day trying to meet the needs of all Vermonters facing food insecurity. It's the Vermont Food Bank. John Sales is the CEO of the Food Bank, and he joins me now. John, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint. Do we have John?
Yes, you do have.
Oh, there's John Sales.
Hi, Rick. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I'm happy to be here.
Oh, good. All right. Want to make sure I wasn't snoozing. As long as you are, and now you're awake, we're in good shape.
Yeah.
Okay. And listeners, if you've got a question or a comment about the food bank, or maybe you've been a recipient of one of their programs, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. John, let's start by discussing the structure of the food bank. How are you connected to all the many food shelves that exist throughout the state?
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, we are the only food bank, as we call ourselves, in Vermont. So you can think of ourselves somewhat, think of the food bank somewhat as the kind of the wholesale provider to food shelves. So there are about 215 or 20, give or take, we call network partners. And those are the food shelves in each community, meal sites, after school programs, senior centers, homeless shelters, really all kinds of organizations, nonprofit organizations or faith-based organizations that serve food as part of what they do to help the community, can become partners with the food bank and will either deliver, they can pick up or both food from the food bank, to distribute in the community. The food bank also runs programs on its own, things like the Veggie Van Gogh, which is a mobile produce distribution. That is actually a partnership too, mostly with schools and hospitals all over the state. It's a mobile farmer's market, basically, where we give away fresh food. And then there's programs like the backpack program, which distributes packages of food to kids on Fridays to take home. There's the Community Kitchen Academy, which is a culinary training course that we run in partnership with Feeding Chittenden and Capstone Community Action. And it takes food that would otherwise go to waste that we're rescuing from grocery stores and restaurants and caterers, and then repurposes that food. And people are trained while they're creating meals for folks at those organizations. So there's a lot, and there's more, and there's a lot that goes on in the community.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of those programs during this hour. I can't wait to dive into them. Really interesting work that you do. John, how many Vermonters do you assist in some way during a typical year?
A typical year is probably around 150,000 at one point or another. Now, that doesn't mean that 150,000 people are going to the food shelf every week.
Mm-hmm.
But folks who, you know, who in a normal times, you know, are between jobs or there's an illness or unexpected expenses and they, you know, they need some extra help. But then there's the older Vermonters who are getting meals at a senior center and kids whose families maybe go to a parent child center that gets food from the Vermont Food Bank. So we touch a lot of lives.
I'd like to contrast that typical year with what you've seen in 2020. Normally, what percentage of Vermonters, and again, a typical year, face food insecurity?
So in a typical year, we had roughly 1 in 10 Vermonters were food insecure. So our food insecurity rate was, as calculated by the USDA, Department of Agriculture, was about, you know, maybe 11 to 12%, maybe a little bit lower, had been going down. Actually some researchers from UVM and some other institutions have been doing some surveys, and for April and May, it skyrocketed to about 1 in 3 Vermonters. So from 1 in 10 to 1 in 3. And the latest data we have, which is from about October, shows us at about 1 in 4. So things got a little bit better, but not a whole lot. And certainly nowhere near where we were right before the coronavirus hit.
That is a significant difference from a typical year to this COVID year. So how has that impacted what you've been able to do there at the Vermont Food Bank?
Wow, it's really turned things upside down. You know, we started off in in March, you know, as soon as we knew this was coming, just started buying food like crazy. We knew that our food shelves would need more help. We have a co-op program at the food bank where we purchase food. You know, we can purchase it by the truckload, and then our partners can purchase it through us at that, you know, that lower price. But we knew that the need was going to be great, and so we eliminated the charges. So we're just purchasing food and giving it away, really. And then, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of our partnership that we formed with the state and the National Guard, and we got the FEMA MREs. I think that was in April or May, and that's when we first started seeing the distributions, mass distributions at the airports and the big lines. We knew we needed food quickly, and so we went to FEMA and got that. And then the federal government stood up this Farmers to Families Food Box program, which kind of took over from the FEMA MRE distributions, where people were getting, and still are, frankly, the opportunity to pick up boxes of fresh produce, fresh fruits and vegetables, and some dairy, and then some pre-cooked meat products, so like deli meats and things like that.
Were you shocked at the time, John, at the line that showed up at the airport there in Barrie when you started to distribute those boxes?
Not really. I know lots of people were shocked.
Yeah.
I think we at the food bank, we had actually been letting people know that they should be prepared for a really big response. You know, when literally tens of thousands of people were losing their jobs, it's a scary thing, even if you're not out of money yet. And it was, you know, it was not shocking because we knew the demand was going to be huge, and we knew that we had to figure out how we're going to meet the demand. And doing a logistical effort like those distributions, it's going to take a few times to kind of figure out the flow. And I think we were able to do that, and distributions now go very, very smoothly. But it was kind of chaotic, and I would say, you know, people were understandably concerned.
Yeah. I mentioned in my introduction the use of the terms hunger and food insecurity, with the latter having kind of replaced the former. What are the differences between hunger and food insecurity?
Well, as you said, Rick, you know, hunger is a physical sensation. You know, we still use the terms interchangeably because, frankly, food insecurity feels a little clinical. Mm-hmm. But food insecurity is actually a definition of the United States Department of Agriculture. It's a family or a person would be counted as food insecure if they meet certain criteria, which is basically a questionnaire that the Census Bureau developed with researchers. So there's 7 or 8 questions. You know, did you run out of food before you had money to purchase more food? You know, have you skipped meals in the last, you know, 2 weeks? Just a series of questions that kind of get at whether people have access to enough nourishing food to meet their daily needs and to live an active and healthy lifestyle.
I want to delve into the consequences of food insecurity, and I'd like to start with those of school age and talk about how not having adequate nutrition can affect their performance in school, John.
Yeah, you know, I'll say the research around schools and hunger, our experts in Vermont are Hunger Free Vermont, and we work very, very closely with them. So I just want to shout out to Hunger Free Vermont and the great work they do. You know, the research is crystal clear that if kids and their developing brains aren't getting the proper nourishment and proper nutrition, that it has significant effects on brain development. And it's not only brain development, it's also, you know, behavior issues. If you talk to any teacher, they will tell you that kids who come to school hungry, they misbehave, they can't pay attention, they spend more time in the nurse's office. They're just, you know, just clear and distinct signs of kids who aren't getting enough food to eat at home. And, you know, teachers will tell you too, that they're feeding their kids, you know, they're buying food, using their money and going in and making sure that those kids have a little food so they can pay attention. I mean, you talked about being hungry, the sensation, and I think we've all experienced the idea of not being able to pay attention and being grouchy, you know, hangry.
Right.
You know, imagine if that was really a normal part of your life. And if you're a small child, and, you know, you don't know what's going on. And so it's really challenging.
Mm. And is there a stigma for those children who receive free or reduced breakfast or lunch when they're at school?
You know, I think that there still is. I think it's lessening somewhat. One of the real challenges is the kids who maybe aren't eligible for those school meals, but still can't afford to buy lunch or bring lunch in, and they're just missing meals at school or racking up student debt and then having collection agencies come after the parents just because the kids need to eat at school. There is some stigma with getting free school meals. And as I said, I think it's less. One thing that's been happening in Vermont, and actually with the coronavirus, the pandemic, has expanded to every child, is now universal school meals. Mm. So now, right now, if you're in school, you get fed. It doesn't matter what your family's income is. And in fact, there were about a quarter of schools in Vermont that were part of a program that were doing that already before coronavirus hit. So that really, takes away the stigma.
Yeah.
When everyone goes to the cafeteria and just gets fed. And actually, they find that the data will tell you that more students are eating meals in school when it's free for everybody.
Wow.
It just makes sense.
Yeah. John Sales, I want to talk a little bit more about food insecurity. We mentioned earlier the rise in the number of those in Vermont who are food insecure. Has the person seeking food from the food shelves changed since the pandemic?
The stories we've been hearing are that many, many people are, getting food help for the first time, whether it's going to a local food shelf or a Veggie Van Gogh, one of our produce distributions, or picking up at the Farmers to Families food box. And the data we have for that nationally through our national organization, Feeding America, is that somewhere around 40% of the people who are getting food help now are doing that for the first time.
And I'm going to go back to that word stigma. Does that still keep people from who need that assistance from seeking it?
I believe that it does. You know, the most effective and useful anti-hunger program in this country is the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which in Vermont is called Three Squares Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Also used to be known as food stamps. It provides people who are income eligible with an EBT card that you go to the grocery store or the farmer's market and pick out the foods that you want and need, just like those of us that have the money to purchase our food do. And there is, unfortunately, tremendous stigma around that program. We really encourage people, if they think they might be eligible, if they've lost jobs and aren't getting enough unemployment income, to check and see. And if I could, there is a texting service that we run. If you text VFB SNAP to 85511, you can go through a short series of questions to see if you might be eligible for Three Squares Vermont. And, you know, there's, you know, people worry sometimes about, well, does somebody else need it more than me? It is the kind of program where everyone is eligible and there is funding for everyone who signs up for the program. So you're not taking any benefits away from others. And I like to think of it also as kind of akin to Social Security. You wouldn't say no to your Social Security payments.
Right.
And people who have been, you know, working and paying in and paying their taxes have been funding the SNAP program. And if now there's a time when it's, you know, when you need some assistance to make sure that you, you know, are able to stay healthy and able to work when there's work available, then you should be using that program.
Absolutely. Let's take a call now. Marley is calling from Worcester. Marley, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you for taking my call. My question is, what the gentleman plans to do with the $9 million that's just been allocated to the food shelf in Vermont?
Thank you, Marley, for that call. And to bring everybody up to speed, last week it was announced that $9 million had been awarded to the Vermont Food Bank. And that was from Mackenzie Scott, the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos. So let me just ask this before we get to, you know, what you will do with it. First of all, you know, what did you think the moment you heard that you were getting $9 million last week?
Yeah, when you hear that, it's kind of a shock. It's
right.
By far the largest gift the food bank has ever gotten. And, you know, and I think that shock kind of, you know, turns to humility and gratitude, that it's an opportunity to do some of the things that maybe as an organization we've kind of dreamed of but haven't had the resources to do. And, you know, as Marley's question brings up, it's also a real responsibility. You know, the food bank in all times is really a steward of resources to benefit all the people in Vermont. And with this extraordinary gift, you know, even more so, I think we need to be very thoughtful about how that money is used, and I'd be happy to talk more about our ideas so far.
Well, sure, go right ahead. I think people are very interested to know, you know, how this might impact the Vermont Food Bank.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, I need to make it clear that, you know, one person alone or one gift, even a $9 million gift, is not going to solve hunger in Vermont.
Right.
You know, the food bank's annual cash operating budget is close to $9 million. And if you add in the value of all the donated food and services, our annual budget in a regular year is more closer to $25 or $30 million.
Wow.
So, you know, so we're at a scale where, you know, where this is really significant, but it's not going to set us up for the next decade.
Right.
On the other hand, if you look at, you know, I mentioned Three Squares Vermont. Three Squares Vermont benefits are closer to $10 million a month that come into Vermont in food assistance. So that's, you know, $110 to $120 million a year. And there's no way that an organization like the food bank can fill in the gap if, you know, if Congress were to reduce those kinds of benefits. Mm-hmm. But getting more to Marley's question, you know, as we think about this, there are really three things at the top of mind for me. The first is that we need to be able to continue kind of the extraordinary response from the extraordinary need around the coronavirus. And so we've gotten tremendous amounts of support from philanthropic donors. The state of Vermont, through the CARES Act funding that came to the state, $4.7 million of that came to the food bank. And frankly, we've spent all of that. You know, it needs to be spent by the end of December, and we've done that by just bringing more food in and getting more food out to people in Vermont. So we have to make sure that over the next year, at least, I think the increased food need is going to be with us, that we can meet that need.
Yeah.
And the second broad category is really to engage the community. I can't just decide what's best for Vermont. That's not the way things work.
Right.
So we have lots of partners. You know, we have 300 community partners in the state. So we need to start listening. I've already started getting a few emails from folks, partners, you know, like Willing Hands, which is a gleaning and food distribution organization in the Upper Valley that does amazing work.
Yeah.
There is an effort going on run out of Bennington College in Bennington, to try and address on a broad scale food insecurity in that part of the state. So we need to talk to people that are doing this work. And then it's also about the root cause of hunger. So we know that hunger is really just a byproduct of not having enough money to buy food. So it really is an economic situation. And the reason we have poverty really in Vermont and in the country, in my opinion, and that of a lot of people, is, you know, systemic oppression and racism and other inequalities. And so how do we leverage these funds by partnering with others to address those root causes of hunger, so that not only are we feeding people today, but we're changing the systems so that people aren't in the position of not being able to afford food.
We're getting close. Go ahead.
Yeah,
please do.
Go ahead. Just quick. The third thing is really the gaps that we see, and one of the big ones is kind of that last mile. So folks who can't get to a food shelf or a meal distribution, how do we set up transportation systems, which is a big issue in a rural state like Vermont? And then there are other discrete issues like that we really want to work on.
We're almost close to a break, but was this something that you actually had to apply for, or was this completely out of the blue, John?
It was completely out of the blue.
Wow.
I got an email and then a phone call. And this is the way that Mackenzie Scott's been distributing her money. And, you know, it's a great surprise to have.
Fantastic surprise. Thank you, Mackenzie Scott. We do have a caller on the line, Stephen. We'll get to you after our break. John Sales of the Vermont Food Bank with us this hour to discuss food insecurity, its effects, and what his organization does to help people around the state. You can call us to join the discussion at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. CBS News Update next, and then we'll be back with more from John Sales of the Vermont Food Bank.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. There were days my mom was packing our lunches and she'd ask me if I'd like a cheese and green pepper sandwich or a mayonnaise and lettuce sandwich. I've never been a very fussy eater and they were tasty enough, so I always said yes. It wasn't until years later I realized that mom only had enough lunch meat for three of our four kids, so I was in effect getting a wish sandwich. But I had a lunch, and I never went hungry, and I never have. Yet many of our friends and neighbors and their children do, more so during this pandemic than before. The Vermont Food Bank is that institution that can't rest knowing that there is someone, some kid, who won't even have that mayo and lettuce sandwich in their lunch today. So I'm speaking with the Vermont Food Bank CEO, John Sales, about what the need is and how they meet it for those among us facing food insecurity. And listeners, if you'd like to discuss food insecurity or have a question about the food bank, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And let's go to the phones and speak with Stephen in Montpelier. Stephen, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi. John, this is Stephen. I used to volunteer at the Barry Food Bank from 9 to 12 every Friday. And I was just wondering if that program is still continuing where people can volunteer to help.
That's a great question. It's been really challenging since COVID. One of our main focuses now is making sure that our operations team stays healthy. We have, you know, drivers that are out on the road 5 days a week delivering all this food and folks in our warehouses putting the orders together. And, you know, there's a lot of logistical work So we have continued to use volunteers because we rely on our volunteers at the food bank to really get the work done. We've reduced the number of volunteers at our distribution centers in Barrie, in Rutland, and in Brattleboro. So we have fewer than five at a time in the building and make sure that they have all the personal protective equipment they need and are, you know, can keep proper distance from others while doing their work. So while we're still using volunteers, we're just being more cautious about it. There still are lots of volunteer opportunities out in the community at distributions. So at our, mostly at our Veggie Van Gogh distributions, which are outside and all over the state. And so if you go to our website, vtfoodbank.org, you can click on Get Involved and check out the volunteer opportunities.
John, I want to talk a little bit more about finances. You mentioned the $9 million a year budget. You got the $9 million award from Mackenzie Scott. Does the food bank have an endowment currently, or is that something that you might look at providing, using some of this money for?
We do not have an endowment, and we don't plan on creating one. Over the years, I've been at the food bank now almost 12 years. We've talked to our donors, some of our larger donors particularly, about starting an endowment. And almost universally, people say, I don't want my money to be sitting in the bank and you just spending the interest. I'm donating because I want that money to go to work to both feed people today and make sure that people don't need food help tomorrow. So I don't think we'll be creating an endowment, but this will give us an opportunity to have some longer range spending. So it's, you know, even if we wanted to, we couldn't spend the $9 million, you know, overnight. And we don't want to. We want to use this as an investment in some longer term initiatives to really make, as I said, some systems change. But it will be really helpful to be able to, to be able to plan over a longer term. You know, we raise money every year, and we need to continue raising that money to continue to provide the services we provide. And we want that money to be as quickly as possible out in the community making a difference.
Are you worried that people will hear about this gift, which is phenomenal, but think, Oh, well, the food bank is all set. They don't need my contribution. They don't need my help.
Sure. And of course that would be a concern. And frankly, we've gotten some calls from people saying, you know, I'm not going to be donating this year or I'm going to, you know, stop my monthly donation because I think you guys are okay. And that's fine too. You know, we are just so grateful for anyone and everyone who chooses to help their neighbors, you know, through the Vermont Food Bank. Cause again, I see the food bank really as a steward in our community. And whatever donations come to the food bank are really about, our mission, you know, to gather and share quality food and nurture partnerships so that no one in Vermont will go hungry. This is a long-term effort. As I said, you know, no one gift is going to solve hunger in Vermont or across the country. And certainly this will help us be more creative and over the long term, hopefully make some really positive impact on the state.
What are some of the greatest needs that the food bank has right now, John?
Right now, it's really the logistics. It's keeping our drivers safe and healthy out on the road. It's getting food in while the supply chains were interrupted kind of briefly at the beginning of COVID. There still are some delays, and so it's. There are longer lead times when we're ordering food now. So instead of a truckload coming, you know, 3 weeks after we order it, it might be 8 weeks. So just keeping that food flowing and coming in. Also the cost of food. I think everyone has noticed who goes grocery shopping that food costs are up. And the data shows us that they're up more than they have been in a long, long time. And that's true for folks like us who are buying large quantities of food. You know, over the longer term, over the next couple of years, you know, we're going to see increased food costs. And then it's really, as I talked about a little earlier, it's one of the biggest challenges is how do we get the food to people where they need it and when they need it. And that's always been a challenge. You know, our partners out there, many of them are volunteer driven. Some like Capstone Community Action or Feeding Chittenden or Foodworks are nonprofits with full-time staff, but a lot of them are literally a couple people in a community location or a church basement that are giving out food. And so we want to make sure that they stay healthy, that they're able to be open, and that they can get the food to the people when they need it.
And John, early on, you talked about some of the programs that the Food Bank institutes. I want to make sure we have time to talk about a few of those. One was the Community Kitchen Academy. Tell us about that.
The Community Kitchen Academy is a culinary job training program for people who are unemployed or underemployed. We work with folks like Vocational Rehab Vermont and VABIR, Vermont Association they help people get jobs. Mm-hmm. And so folks who have had some barriers in their lives oftentimes, and the program, which we run in partnership with Feeding Chittenden and Capstone Community Action, it's actually, we have chef instructors and the students is actually continuing to go on during COVID. We kind of rejiggered the program. But in usual times, there's 10 to 12 students, and literally we rescue food from the grocery stores around Vermont. And a lot of that food is, you know, it was culled from the shelves. It doesn't have a lot of shelf life left on it. And so it goes to these Community Kitchen Academy, and the chef instructor, while teaching culinary skills, takes this food that we've rescued, and they turn it into these amazing, delicious portions of food that are then just given out either frozen or hot meals sometimes at Chittenden, Feeding Chittenden. And then the students graduate with a certificate. They have a ServSafe certificate. They have the alcohol service certificate. We have about a 90% placement rate in full-time jobs.
Wow.
Folks like Sodexo love our graduates because they're so well-trained, not only in how to prepare food, but in, you know, how to work in a kitchen, how to be cooperative, how to resolve conflict. Just, you know, it's really about the whole person and not just job skills.
I know Capstone has Joey Buttendorf running that program. I hope to have her on here in the next few weeks to talk about it. Another food rescue program, and I love this so much. You kind of alluded to it earlier, but the programs that glean.
Right. So gleaning is really an ancient thing. It's talked about in the Bible, and it's about taking the food or harvesting the food in farmers' fields that wouldn't otherwise be harvested. So in modern days here in Vermont, it's, farmers who, you know, maybe they grew some spinach and they went through and they picked the first growth of spinach and didn't get around to replanting those rows. And so the spinach grew back. And the farmer doesn't have a market for that. And so they'll call our gleaners and we'll get some volunteers or all volunteers go out in the field and pick that spinach. It gets bagged, thrown into a truck, and usually driven directly to a food shelf or meal site where then, you know, farm fresh, often organic produce right from Vermont farms into the hands of people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford to buy that. The food bank runs gleaning programs in Rutland and Brattleboro, and then we partner with others. You know, I mentioned Willing Hands here in central Vermont. There's Central Vermont Community Harvest, and there's different gleaning organizations in other parts of the state. Salvation Farms is another one.
Yeah, so good. And while we're on the topic of vegetables, the Veggie Van Gogh program, tell us about that as well.
Yeah, Veggie Van Gogh is really like a farmer's market, a free farmer's market. So we started actually many years ago working with the JFK School in Winooski, and shout out to them. They are an amazing crew there, doing what we called school pantry. And we take all fresh produce, so fruits and vegetables, and set it up like a farmer's market and have people can walk along and shop and say, you know, I'll take a couple of those and a couple of those. And it grew into this Veggie Van Gogh, where we work with schools and hospitals. Right now, there's well over 30 locations all over the state. And either once or twice a month, the food bank, in normal times, we'd show up and we set up brightly colored tents and bins and have volunteers. And you shop just like at a farmer's market. Mm-hmm. Of course, now that's not COVID safe. And so all the produce, the vegetables are pre-bagged. And people can just drive through, and get a bag of produce and maybe some dairy or some other healthy food, some yogurt, just plopped in the car or tucked in the trunk and drive on. So it's safe for everybody, and people are still able to access those fresh foods.
John, speaking directly to Vermonters, tell them why it's important to make sure that everyone in our community has a sufficient amount to eat.
You know, the food is one of the most important things. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but you think about the emotional connection that people have to food also. You know, our first food is literally from our mother's bodies. There's nothing more emotional than that. We know about the importance of food in development of children. You know, it's unquestioned. And even adults, you know, people who are worried about where their next meal is coming from or whether there's enough food in the kitchen, they're not thinking about, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow at work? They're not thinking about how am I going to get engaged in my community? They're not thinking about running for office or much less voting. They're thinking about where's my next meal going to come from? And to the extent that we can solve hunger in Vermont so that nobody has to worry about where their meal's coming from, it's going to lift us all up. People are going to, kids are going to be ready for school. They're going to play and be active and grow up. There's going to be fewer behavioral problems. Adults are going to be starting businesses, working hard in their jobs, getting engaged in their communities. It only is going to lift us all up if people do not have to worry about where their next meal is coming from.
And I know there's a great need at the holidays. We focus on that a lot. But what's your need, you know, come January 2nd and after the February 8th, after the holidays?
Hunger is year round. There really is not a season of hunger. We do focus on it in the holidays, and I think that's great. And there's a lot of community effort to reach out to people. But think about in the summertime when school ends and the kids are no longer getting those two meals at school. It's a lot of pressure on households to up the food budget. You know, think about our older Vermonters who year round are struggling with small fixed incomes and transportation issues. So it really is a year round effort. And you know, we're committed to making sure that as much as possible, people have the food they need on their tables every day of the year.
John Sales is the CEO of the Vermont Food Bank, and you can learn more about their mission to end food insecurity in the state. You can make a contribution, learn about volunteer opportunities at their website. That's vtfoodbank.org. John Sales, I want to thank you for being on the show. I want to thank you and everyone at the food bank for the work you do, and congratulations on that gift of $9 million. Well deserved.
You're welcome, Rick. It's great to be here, and thank you for the congratulations, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to all your listeners.
It was our pleasure. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs, and it is directed by Danny McKivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, and you can feel free to suggest topics or guests. I'm always open. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. And Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next here on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.